Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. In West Virginia, Executive Director of Main Street Fairmont, Kate Green, sees a city on the move.
This is a great place to be, and I keep telling everybody, I'm like, 2 years, 2 years. You give us two more years, and Fairmont will be, it'll be a whole new place.
And the same can be said for the Clinch River region of southwestern Virginia.
And everybody was trying to just frustrated in what we could do, but when you looked at it from the Clinch River, all of a sudden, this is a town with enormous potential and enormous assets.
And we learn about Tennessee State Park Ranger Bobby Fulcher, who spent the last three decades traveling the Tennessee hills to record folk music.
There's a difference between hearing someone sing a song that doesn't really believe that there are ghosts or haunts and someone who believes that they're real.
These are among the stories inside Appalachia this week. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Across Appalachia, it's apple season, and that means it's also the time of year when communities used to come together to press fresh apple cider. Today, some of those old traditions are being preserved by people who still make cider the old-fashioned way, with a wooden cider press. And there are also cideries in many areas where local apples are grown. Reporter Lydia Wilson found one cidery in Albemarle County, Virginia, and brings us these sounds.
This is Jupiter's Legacy, our toast to Monticello and Mr. Jefferson and colonial America. I'm Charlotte Shelton, and we are in the tasting room of Albemarle Cider Works in North Garden, Virginia. When we decided that one way to justify having 250 varieties of apple trees, which is a lunatic way to grow an orchard this day and age, I'll just tell you or anyone else, making cider was a natural. We were interested in the history of these varieties. A lot of them were used for cider. I think the future of cider depends on us establishing a market in which it's its own channel. It's not wine, it's not beer. It's distinct and special. These are dry ciders, all of them probably best with food. Our Jupiter's Legacy and the drier ones are fantastic with traditional American cuisine. Think of your Thanksgiving dinner, turkey and dressing. I mean, it's hard to find a wine that really does justice to turkey and dressing. Now, I claim no credit for creating the cider. My brother is the ciderist, Chuck.
In our first year in business, it's been kind of rewarding. As you know, cider is kind of being reintroduced to America. Cider died out for a number of reasons, and in the demise of cider, a lot of the orchards disappeared. A lot of the apple varieties almost disappeared or did completely disappear, so you just got to bring the orchards back.
Most of them don't know what we've got, or if they think they know, they're thinking of something else. They're either thinking of fresh cider or juice. So I think something special about what we're doing is creating American cider. I refer to this as the American Cider Revival.
This story was produced by With Good Reason, which is supported by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. If you're interested in finding a local cidery near you, check out wvpublic.org. Now, here's a story about another popular Appalachian beverage, beer. In West Virginia, the craft beer industry is growing, so brewers are turning to the state legislature for help in expanding further. Members of the West Virginia Craft Brewers Guild recently presented some ideas at the state capitol. Dave Mistich of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
Blackwater Brewing Company owner and brewer Lincoln Wilkins told the Joint Committee on Economic Development that his industry is growing, but current state law is keeping it from becoming a bigger economic force. As a member of the State Craft Brewers Guild, Wilkins says the biggest problem is licensing. There's a $1,500 resident brewer's license just to make the beer, and there's an additional $1,000 to operate a brew pub on site. At any other bar, that's only a $150 license. Both the resident brewer and brew pub license require additional state bonds. Wilkins says it's much easier in states like Ohio.
Really, these states have streamlined this process and pulled back from either pulled back or structured their licensure process in such a way that is not such a burdensome financial amount on the breweries that are starting up.
Wilkins thinks breweries should have just one required license, and the fee should be on a sliding scale to incentivize startups. But West Virginia Alcohol Beverage Control Administration General Counsel Anup Bashin says integrating the licenses may be difficult.
I think it'd be problematic. It's two different functions, two different tiers, and we try to maintain a separation of those tiers and those functions.
Bashin points out that some changes have been made for brewers to better self-distribute, but federal case law puts limits on that. Brewers are also concerned about laws that lock them into long-term agreements with distributors. Philip Reel of the West Virginia Beer and Wine Wholesalers Association argued against breaking down that three-tiered system of brewers, distributors, and retailers.
I don't know that anybody disagrees with the notion that perhaps some of the fees maybe are higher than they should be, or that that you could try to streamline the process as much as you could. But again, in doing that, you have to be really careful that you don't disrupt the control.
Brewers also want more flexibility in their operations, hoping to match the ability of wineries and distilleries to have tastings, provide limited sampling, and sell more of their product directly to the public to be consumed off-site. They've also taken issue with the labeling process. The state requires a certified laboratory analysis of alcohol by volume and sales approval of products. Mountain State Brewing Company owner and guild president Brian Arnett says that happens out of state and could take up to 40 days.
So you have beer sitting there waiting for the analysis to come back. Then it goes to the state, and you have to wait for the state approval to come back as well. So sometimes you brew your beer, you're waiting 60 days.
It's a long wish list, but craft brewers hope to help draft a bill that would bring about some of these changes. Lawmakers could consider the issue when they return full time in January. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Dave Mistich in Charleston.
Continued news about conflicts between faith groups around the globe inspired interfaith discussions recently in Morgantown, West Virginia. A forum on religious diversity explored what different faiths teach about social justice, tolerance, and compassion. Glynis Board of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports.
Faith leaders met inside the Greater St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church to share their faith's teachings on social justice, tolerance, and compassion with members of the community. The turnout was a postcard of diversity. 100 people of different ages, races, and religions filled the Methodist pews to listen to the interfaith dialogue. Co-chair of the Community Coalition for Social Justice, Rosa Becker, says her group organized the event after one of their monthly meetings.
I think we were bemoaning the state of the world. I mean, there's been so much violence recently, and some often in the name of religion, and I think we were just thinking, what can we do? I mean, our mission is to promote tolerance.
The Community Coalition for Social Justice is a group of organizations and individuals in the Morgantown area dedicated to promoting the principles of social and economic justice. Co-chair Susan Brown adds that Morgantown is well-suited for such interfaith discussions.
There's such a diversity of religions in this community that we felt this is perfect town for us to help educate people about other religions, because education is key to tolerance, and that's what we hope to convey tonight.
Tolerance, or the ability to have sympathy for beliefs that may not be our own, is just one thought the forum explored. The social justice group asked each of the six religious leaders two questions. What does your religion teach about social justice and tolerance? And what do you teach about compassion?
The AME Church was born out of an injustice. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, whose founders affirmed their humanity in the face of slavery and racism, stands in defense of disadvantaged and oppressed people in the 21st century.
In the Baha'i faith, there's a council, sort of the first council, is to possess a pure, kindly, and radiant heart. that thine might be a sovereignty, ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. And this is the first teaching in the Hidden Words by Baha'u'llah, who's the prophet founder of the Baha'i Faith. And it really speaks to, I think, the core purpose of the core struggle of a human being.
Well, you know, Islam is one of the great monotheistic religions. And we follow the same message as all the prophets from Adam, Abraham, Moses, Jesus, and the final prophet, Muhammad, peace be upon all of them. Now, what we believe is that there is one creator, and he has created us all equal, without any discrimination. So we're all equal before his sight. We are loved by him. He's a compassionate creator.
Buddhism really is a very tolerant faith. In fact, the Dalai Lama has said on multiple occasions that people should actually stay with their native religions if they can. It actually is not a very proselytizing religion. So in Buddhism, we believe in the beauty of all faiths, and it's best to keep a nice peace of mind because that actually is more helpful to you than the Buddhist teachings sometimes.
Well, Judaism was the first religion to teach the oneness of God. The one God created all humanity in the divine image, male and female. If we all have one parent, then we are all one family.
In Hinduism, we accept all religion. We don't say something is superior than the other. Just like water. In English, it's water. In my language, it's Jal. In German, it's Wasser, but it's water. So it doesn't matter how you practice. It's the tolerance, because every religion has produced excellent human beings.
There were many shared values connecting the six faiths represented in the forum: compassion, service to the poor. But perhaps the most prominent and repeated value was the idea of justice together with action.
One of the verses of the Quran, for example, says, "Inna Allaha yuhibbul muqsitin," in Arabic, which means, verily God or Allah loves those who are just. The message of Islam is that of justice, of peace.
Baha'is are encouraged to act on a sense of justice, a sense of compassion, to try to bring about transformation within the society more broadly.
Isaiah says Israel is to be a light unto the nations. Amos says God loves all nations equally, and Israel will be judged more stringently than other nations. Micah says humility is more important than ritual correctness. These three are the main social justice prophets, emphasizing reconciliation among nations and justice as the essence of religion.
The other unanimous sentiments were that these kinds of dialogues are key in today's global society, and that there's no room in the world for fanaticism. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Ward in Morgantown.
And you can hear more thoughts from that forum online at wvpublic.org. The Great Smoky Mountains Association is working to release a compact disc in North Carolina. The CD is entitled Carol Best and the White Oak String Band and features recordings made in the 1950s by a little-known musician who has been described as one of the most talented and innovative banjo players in America. Wayne Winkler of WETS has this report.
Carol Best described himself as a fiddle player who didn't play the fiddle. He played the banjo, but he developed a unique three-finger style of playing that emulated the fiddle. On the new compact disc, Carol Best and the White Oak String Band, you can hear one of the earliest examples of that melodic banjo style.
I don't know of anyone who knows an earlier recorded version of a melodic-style banjo solo.
Ted Olson is a professor of Appalachian Studies at East Tennessee State University and a three-time Grammy Award nominee for his work on the Bristol Sessions box set and the old-time Smoky Mountain Music CD. The nonprofit Great Smoky Mountains Association released the old-time Smoky Mountain Music CD, and Olson worked with the association to produce the Carol Best CD.
Carol Best was one of the unheralded banjo players in the history of Appalachian music. As a musician, he was always adventurous, always evolving in terms of his style. He was somebody who never got any credit for his innovations, but other famous people intersected with him at some point in their careers, learned a great deal, and went on to fame and fortune.
Carroll Best lived in the Crabtree community of Haywood County, North Carolina. Both his parents played the banjo, and young Carroll developed a style of picking using three fingers of his right hand to play the melody of fiddle tunes.
It's essentially that approach that enhances the melodic aspect of every tune, which means that you can't rely on the old Scruggs roll style that banjo players in bluegrass are quite familiar with. It's a beautiful style, but it's a style that's at some level kind of rhythmic as opposed to melodic. And so the melodic style that Carroll Best kind of pioneered was beautiful. It had a kind of a tapestry of melody notes to any given tune. And he learned it because he played the banjo around fiddle players at square dances and such in Haywood County, North Carolina, where he grew up and lived all his life.
Other banjo players knew about him, but the general public didn't. Was that a matter of his choice, or was it just that he never got the breaks?
You would have to say that it was his choice. He served for about 2 months as the banjo player in the Morris Brothers bluegrass band. The Morris Brothers introduced the song Salty Dog Blues, you know, way back when in the early 30s. So they were in some ways pre-bluegrass, but they stuck around and kind of adapted an early pioneering bluegrass sound to their group. And there was a steady succession of great banjo players in the Morris Brothers band, starting with Wade Maynor and then Earl Scruggs and then Don Reno and then Carroll Best. Carroll Best played for only 2 months, though, with the Morris Brothers when he decided that the life of a touring musician was not for him. So he dropped out of the music scene, went back home for keeps, worked his farm, started working in a factory, took care of his family, something he was very proud of, and in essence played recreationally.
Best was playing at the home of his brother-in-law in 1956 when he was recorded by folklorist Joseph Sargent Hall. In the 1930s, Hall had made spoken word recordings of people who lived in the area that was soon to become the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. But he also recorded songs, many of which were released in 2010 on the Grammy-nominated Old Time Smoky Mountain Music CD. The Great Smoky Mountains Association wanted Olson to produce another disc of material from Hall's recordings. Initially, Olson was concerned that there wasn't enough good material in those recordings to warrant another CD release.
But lo and behold, I discovered that here at East Tennessee State University, we had a different kind of cachet of Joseph Sargent Hall field recordings made in the Smokies area, but this time in the 50s. And that led me to discover lost recordings, the earliest recordings known of the great Carroll Best. It was quite a revelation because Carroll Best was known to have forged this style early on, long before others, before Bobby Thompson, before Bill Keith. But we never had the recordings to prove this until we discovered these recordings in the archives of Appalachia, East Tennessee State University.
So those tapes had just been kind of sitting there. Nobody really knew what they were.
A few of the tapes were in the Library of Congress, but that didn't mean that anyone knew what was there either. But there were other recordings, and I would say the most valuable recordings on this set were in the Archives of Appalachia only, featuring Carroll Best playing at his in-law's house near Waynesville, North Carolina, out in the country. Do a considerable amount of sound preservation and mastering. And I want to give the credit for that part of the project to John Fleener, who's the media collections manager at the Archives of Appalachia. John was very patient to listen to everything multiple times and to figure out exactly how to keep the balance between the original dynamics, but also bringing the sound forward more. In a lot of cases, he had to unlayer the fiddle and the banjo because they were kind of locked in. Sonically, you couldn't distinguish one from the other, and he made it so that you could. because really our focus was on Carol Best's banjo playing ultimately. We wanted people to hear what he was doing instrumentally. And that took, you know, a great deal of patience from an engineering perspective.
Though Carol Best wasn't widely known to the public, he did establish a reputation among banjo players.
Those people who heard him were those lucky few who heard him at a festival or perhaps stopped by his house, which happened in the case of Bill Keith, the man who was kind of credited with that melodic three-finger banjo style that used to be called for years and years the Keith style, because Bill Keith played it with Bill Monroe for a period of time in the early 60s. Allegedly, Bill Keith and many other banjo players took a pilgrimage to Carol Best's farm and studied, you know, got informal lessons from Carol Best. We'll never know definitively how much Bill Keith learned. He doesn't claim to have been there, so it's a speculative thing. But a lot of, you know, other people in the community and Carol Best's family remember Bill Keith's presence at the farm at one point in the early 60s. Well, be that as it may, another gentleman who befriended Carol Best in the late 50s, a young banjo player named Bobby Thompson, met Carol Best, and they were on adjoining television programs. Bobby Thompson was with the Carl Story Band, and so there was some overlap there in the studio, and allegedly they met. This is, in fact, fairly well documented, and Bobby Thompson was, you know, freely talked about it. So he learned a thing or two from Carol Best, who was an older man and therefore had played the banjo longer and had perhaps more time to experiment.
Aside from a few banjo players, though, Carol Best remained unknown outside his home area in western North Carolina.
So he was a bit of an unheralded, undiscovered genius until the 1990s, when Joe Wilson, the executive director of the National Council for Traditional Arts, put him on some national tours, and he started to develop a great deal of popularity. He started to get some recognition in the 90s after playing the banjo for decades and being innovative all that time. He suddenly started to get some attention. He traveled with people like Ralph Stanley and J.D. Crow and many, many others, Tony Trischka. The list goes on of the banjo players who considered him their peer. And then in 1995, he was tragically murdered right at the kind of the height of his arrival on the music scene.
What actually happened to him?
His brother shot him. Allegedly, his brother had run into some difficulties, and, you know, I don't want to speculate human psychology here, but from what I can tell, perhaps there was a bit of a jealousy a situation, because Carol Best, by 1995, was suddenly starting to become kind of a national figure for the first time in his career. Joe Wilson was taking Carol Best on national tours with Ralph Stanley. It was called the Masters of the Banjo Tour, and I think Carol Best was slated to do an album that might have been a kind of a breakout album, as they say. Beyond that, I can't really speculate.
What happened to the brother?
The brother went to prison, was eventually paroled, and he passed away a few years ago.
Carol Best didn't get the recognition he deserved during his lifetime, but this new compact disc will give listeners the opportunity to discover his melodic banjo style. A release party for Carol Best and the White Oak String Band will take place in Lake Junaluska, North Carolina, on Friday, September 19th at 7:30 p.m. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Wayne Winkler.
It's time now to explore What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. This week, the stories are more folklore than history. We're exploring a town in Kentucky that is said to have gotten its name from a body part. Well, sort of. Stick around to find out what's in a name. This is Inside Appalachia. So what's in the name of Neon, Kentucky? But before we get into that, I want to follow up to last week's segment. You might remember we explored a town called Lily in West Virginia and the people who lived there. At the time, I wasn't able to find my place on the family tree, but since the show aired, a listener has helped me to track my ancestors all the way back to the original settlers of the village of Lily. So special thanks goes out to Bob Zingo, or Cousin Bob. Now, on to Neon, Kentucky. According to Jeff Hawkins, who grew up in the town, there are two versions to the story. Both versions say that Neon began as a non-coal company town. Unlike its neighbors, Fleming or Haymond, Neon was not created as a coal camp. Still, one tell explains Neon as an unofficial train stop for trains that were operated by the coal industry. Conductors would slow the train down, and folks wanting to get on were told to put their knee on the train car, hence the name Neon. Now, the other tale is one of neon lights. Since the town wasn't ran or owned by a coal company, merchants had more freedom to open stores in city limits. Some of those merchants used gas signage and lights. Jeff Hawkins tells us that Neon might have been one of the area's first business centers to use neon lights, hence the name Neon. So that's the folklore behind what's in the name of Neon, Kentucky. If you have another story about Neon or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might just explore it. Inside Appalachia. These are uncertain economic times in central Appalachia. It seems like new coal layoffs are announced somewhere in the region almost every week, and many communities are struggling. As a matter of fact, Patriot Coal sent a warning of possible layoffs to more than 350 miners in West Virginia just a few days ago. While this doesn't guarantee they'll lose their jobs, the same mine in Danville laid off about 100 workers earlier this year. Along the Clinch River in southwest Virginia, some folks are hoping the river itself will help them find a new economic base. WMMT's Rich Kirby brings us this report.
My name is David Sutherland. I am the mayor here in Cleveland, Virginia, in beautiful southwest Virginia.
Cleveland is a small town on the banks of the Clinch River in Russell County, Virginia. We were gathered in the Town Recreation Center last May. About 40 people called together by the Clinch River Valley Initiative, or CURVY, a coalition of individuals and groups working to develop a beautiful but distressed area of southwest Virginia. The town of Cleveland is certainly distressed, but working hard to make things better.
Back in the 40s, it was a larger town. They had a car lot here, a hardware store, a hotel. But with the diminishing of the coal mines, and now that they're pretty much all gone, we're down to trying to change our direction and go to maybe something along the line of ecotourism.
Look ahead for a year. If things go well, what do you hope to have accomplished a year from now?
Well, a year from now, I would like to see that. I think if we get the state park in, it will be a real big help to get people from not only Southwest Virginia, but, you know, all the way around over here to enjoy the river, enjoy the trails that we have that we're going to be offering here in Cleveland, as well as the ones that have been put in St. Paul and the ATV trails in St. Paul. So, you know, we're hoping that we'll all be able to work together along the clinch for everybody to benefit from this.
Cleveland had applied to the federal government for a community development grant. We had come to town to hear what folks planned to do if the grant came through. Much of the work behind the application came from Todd Christensen of the State Department of Housing and Community Development. Part of his job is deciding where an investment of public money would make the most sense, and he liked what he saw in Cleveland.
Cleveland's traditionally been a coal mining-oriented and timbering-related community, and it's gone into a great decline. There's a real need to, they've lost a very substantial amount of their population, and they've lost most of the downtown businesses. There's a number of abandoned commercial buildings along the Clinch River that have been flooded. But because of the Clinch River initiative, we took a different look at Cleveland than in the past. We were just kind of looking at how can we rehab the houses and how could we possibly do some of the downtown, but there's nothing really to build on. But looking at it from the Clinch River, all of a sudden, when we came, a group of us from the Clinch River Initiative came and walked around town, said, oh my God, this isn't a blighting commercial area. It's a mile-long riverfront. There's a mile riverfront in this town. It's just it's like looking at one of those pictures where if you look at it one way, it's two vases. You look at it another way, it's two women. Well, we're looking at Cleveland from the building aspect, and everybody was trying to just frustrated in what we could do. But when you looked at it from the Clinch River, all of a sudden, this is a town with enormous potential and enormous assets. And the biggest asset is the people here are really dedicated to the future. Instead of living in the past or bemoaning the fate of the community, they're energized. They had an election a couple years ago where a very progressive group of people got together. They cleaned up the river. Instead of asking somebody else for help, they did it themselves, which impressed people from the outside, and I know me especially. And when you see a community that shows by example that they want to do something with their community, it makes a big, huge difference in attracting investment from the outside.
After the meeting, it was time for show and tell. One group took off on a float down the river. Another group took a walking tour of town, led by the town clerk, Kathy Johnson, and Debbie Milton of the Cumberland Plateau Planning District.
Now, this building is owned by Holiday, and there was a gentleman that lived upstairs, but they've agreed to let the town purchase the building through block grant funds and take the building down. So that's one of them that's going to be demolished. So
this brick, not this one, but the one up, all of these would be gone and just be like an open area. Because once you take something down in an area like this, it's flood zones.
And we're going to put a green space in here. Mm-hmm. The town is going to we're going to have it graded, and they're just going to have it grass all the way to the river. It's going to be beautiful. We're going to have some picnic tables and that sort of thing.
It used to be a pretty hopping little store, big old grocery store. Something's my understanding. It used to be the Music and Smith grocery store. There used to be some railroad houses here. Railroad still owns that. They took that down. Let's see. The house will leave, you know. But we want to, it's in good shape. It's a private dwelling. So you know, we'll just have a park around instead of these buildings that are falling down. But we'd like to take them to a river trail that would come from the campground and bring the bridge like right across here or somewhere in this area. And then you can go on into downtown up to the Barrens, or you can stay on the river trail and go down to the park.
Just be a pedestrian bridge?
Just a little crossing,
get traffic. Launch here and things. It's like I said, it's a really nice access down to the river in this area.
There aren't many towns that have a river running right in the middle of it. So.
In June came the news everyone was waiting for. The community development grant was approved. This week we visited Town Clerk Kathy Johnson to see how things look today.
You know, to be honest, we had a lot of negativity. You know, you guys, you're wasting your time. You're not going to get the funding. But now that we've gotten the funding, there's a lot more, you know, response from the community. People are starting to get excited. So, you know, we hope that that'll carry on. Maybe we can get some more volunteers. We've got the Cleveland Tourism Committee. We've cleaned up the creek here, you know, parts of the creek. We got like 1,400 pounds of trash out of just a quarter mile section of our creek one day. I couldn't believe it. It's crazy. So, but the more people we can get to help, the better off we're going to be. So, you know, it is a beautiful little place. It just needs some work. So,
Cleveland's project will create a riverfront park, build trails, and fund low-interest loans for new businesses. Kathy Johnson sees it as part of a regional effort which includes the plan for a Clinch River State Park. The park, which has been approved but not yet funded, would be a linear park with units in a number of communities up and down the river.
You know, especially if we get the state park, this is going to be a great place to come, you know, hiking, biking, camping, the whole nine yards. The whole thing is we'd like to start in Tazewell and go all the way to the state line, that you could stop in every little town, you know, and do a two-week vacation and see something different every day. I mean, I think it'll benefit not just Cleveland, but the whole area, you know. And that's something we need here with mining going down, you know. It's just getting a lot of reason for people to come right now to this area. So, you know, we hope we're giving them a reason to want to come here.
Well, we have a nice small little community, and if no one's ever been through Cleveland, they need to get out for a Saturday or Sunday ride and come on through. And if you come through during the week, if you got any suggestions, you can stop at Town Hall there, and we listen to everybody and try to accommodate to whatever degree we can to help anybody out.
David Sutherland, Mayor of Cleveland, Virginia. Reporting for WMMT, I'm Rich Kirby.
Public agencies, private businesses, foundations, and nonprofit groups are constantly striving to inject life and energy into local communities. As Sarah Lowther Hensley of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports, there is no one-size-fits-all formula for successful community development, but sometimes having the right person in the right place at the right time can make all the difference.
It's early evening here at the Joe and Throw Co-op in downtown Fairmont. The business, a partnership between a pottery studio and a coffee and craft beer cafe, has only been open for about 2 months, but it's already attracting new people to downtown.
My name's Bob Lane. I'm a coffee roaster here in Fairmont, and I also work the coffee half of the Joe and Throw Co-op.
And my name is Michael Ray, and I'm a potter and pottery instructor here at the Joe and Throw Co-op.
These two guys met at a beard-growing contest, part of a celebration of the state's 150th birthday last year. They started setting up next to each other at the local farmers market and other venues, but they say they became partners in this bricks-and-mortar business because of Kate Green, executive director of Main Street Fairmont. Lane says Green connected them with an investor and helped get their business off the ground. He says she's very good at connecting key players.
A lot of us are here, but we just didn't know how to connect and like what we could do to really make our town better. It's nice to have a little direction there.
For her part, Green says it's all about relationship building, collaboration, and creativity.
We're a nonprofit, grassroots, so a huge portion of what we do has to be creative because we lack the resources otherwise. And so we're always looking for ways that people fit in and who can help us reach the end goal.
And that end goal, Green says, is a livable community, a sense of place and connection. Next door to Joe and Throw is another new business, All Things Herbal Local Market. Owner Krista Blaze says Green organized opportunities that helped her go from dreaming about opening a business to actually doing it.
Kate's been wonderful. I did the small business boot camp that they did early this winter, and then that kind of gave me the confidence to go ahead and get started.
All the pieces and partners are falling into place, says Green.
We are in a very unique situation right now in Fairmont where our community leaders have that vision. And they are ready to embrace every possible opportunity and move forward. And to have that going for us is pretty big.
Green says Fairmont has solid infrastructure for moving forward, a plentiful supply of historic and available buildings, and many, many creative people willing to get involved. She launched a weekly gathering, the 1230 Room, where those creative people can come pitch an idea and find partners. She says finding money is always a challenge, and she would like to see some state funding dedicated to Main Street programs across the state. Green grew up in Fairmont, but then moved to Montana. 2 years ago, she and her family returned to build their life in her hometown. Catherine Rosdick, Fairmont's Director of Planning and Development, says Green has brought a new energy to community development efforts, an energy that comes from Green's own sense of place and connection.
She's all about building up the community in which she lives, and Fairmont being her hometown. You know, you can kind of see that in the way that she acts and works and plays even.
The Marion County Chamber of Commerce has recognized Kate Green with its Visionary Award, an award that's not given every year. Chamber President Tina Shaw says it's only given under extraordinary circumstances. She says the energy and synergy downtown Fairmont is experiencing is something special, and she credits Green.
She works very well with outside groups. She works very well with her board, with the community, with businesses downtown. And I think she has a very calm effect of things are going to happen downtown.
And Green promises things are going to happen downtown.
This is a great place to be. And I keep telling everybody, I'm like, 2 years, 2 years. You give us two more years and Fairmont will be, it'll be a whole new place.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Sarah Lowther Hensley in Fairmont.
Janice Summers Young is one of two West Virginian artists who were selected for a new exhibit at the Museum of the Shenandoah Valley in Winchester, Virginia. The exhibit called Second Time Around, The Hubcap as Art, features 287 artists from 36 different countries. Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Broadcasting visited Young's studio to talk about using materials from the forest, river, and even the trash to make art.
Experimental. I don't know, you know, where it's going, but I like to experiment.
Janice Summers Young lives in the community of Queen Shoals, about a mile from the Elk River, right on the line between Kanawha and Clay counties. On weekdays, she and her husband Terry work for their construction business. Most weekends, they spend hiking, camping, and collecting materials that Young uses in collages that are on display throughout their home.
I've always loved art. And I've always done some form of art and tried to make my whole life a kind of art.
When Young and her husband began to build their house, they discovered fossils in the rocks that they dug out of the dirt. So they decided to use the fossilized stones to build the exterior of their home.
The area had been coal mined quite a bit some years back. We started building our house here. We started hand-picking our stones from where we had dug here, the excavation, the stones we turned up, and also stones along the creek bank because they're rich in fossils. And I also wanted it to look like this house fit here.
Her art, like her home, also includes objects from nature, from wasp nests that are preserved with porcelain to pieces of driftwood that are constructed into circular collages. These are inspired by whirlpools she finds in rivers.
I had been picking up driftwood pieces and turning them into collages. One rainy day when the rain had fallen on all those tiny pieces and all the colors had lit up in them. And I'm like, oh my gosh, these are beautiful. So the most whirlpools I've seen are on New River. That's my favorite river.
Her work drew the attention of artist Ken Marquis, founder of the Landfill Arts Project. He invited Young to submit a piece of art for the exhibit that opened on September 7th. Over 1,000 artists from around the world were given a hubcap. Each of them repurposed their hubcap in their own way. Young was one of a few hundred artists whose piece was selected for the exhibit.
When I got the hubcap, that's the first thing that entered my mind, was a driftwood piece inside the hubcap. I've seen so many tires and hubcaps in the river, and I watched them pop off the car and roll down the hill and land in the river. And there's the swirl holes where the whirlpools land stuff, and they're circular, and they'll have little bits of wood or stones collected inside of them.
What one person might consider trash, artists like Janice Young see as materials that can be used to create.
I thought it was a really, really neat project that's going to have that many people from all around participating in something that I'm passionate about, you know, just not wasting so much and trying to reuse as much as possible. No, we can't all be environmental saints, but if any little thing that we can do, all adds up eventually.
Young says she doesn't consider herself an environmentalist, but as a West Virginian artist, she does feel inspired by the delicate beauty of the mountains and the rivers. She thinks it's a beauty that is often abused. When she sees trash in the river, she picks it up and tries to turn it into art. Now, that art will be on display in the Museum of the Shenandoah Valley, surrounded by the works of artists from across the world. All 287 of them are tied together by their willingness to create out of the waste that most people call trash. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Queen Shoals, West Virginia.
Today, you can find almost any obscure song or historical recording online, but there was a time when the music was nearly impossible to track down, and the performers who knew the oldest songs were dying off. So in 1976, Congress passed the American Folklife Preservation Act. One of the first to take up the challenge of preserving these songs was a young Tennessee park ranger named Bobby Fulcher. Now that he's nearing retirement, Fulcher looks back on the music he's captured and the friends he made along the way. Mike Osborne of WMOT has this story.
Archivist Wayne Moore leads the way down into the vault where the state of Tennessee stores its most valuable historical treasures.
So this is the vault, as we call it. It's temperature and humidity controlled area where we keep a lot of recordings.
Hundreds of reel-to-reel audio tapes line these floor-to-ceiling shelves.
Almost this entire range here is the Tennessee Folklife Collection.
Stacked atop each other, the recordings, photographs, and lyric sheets in the collection would reach the height of a 14-story building. They were all assembled under the direction of novice folklorist and state park ranger Bobby Fulcher. Most of the material was collected during visits in the homes of Tennesseans like Opal Wright, who Fulcher still visits regularly.
What can you remember about music making at your house?
Lot. I thought the house was going to fall. I never heard so much music in my life.
Wright is the daughter of the late music legend, fiddler John Sharp. Bobby Fulcher is helping the Sharp family restore and release Fiddle and John's surviving recordings. Fulcher is also collecting the stories behind the music.
They'd invite all the musicians and all the neighbors around. They'd all get on their horses on the Friday, and you could hear them coming for a mile. They had their music all fixed on them horses, big old black horses.
Fulcher is a child of the folk era. He grew up listening to Dylan and Baez. But the tunes he heard as a young ranger traveling the Tennessee hills seemed somehow more compelling.
There's a difference between hearing someone sing a song that doesn't really believe that there are ghosts or haints and someone who believes that they're real.
Now said Jimmy, my dearest Nancy, by the heavens if you prove not true, my troubling ghost will haunt you. Forever, dead or alive, love, I mean to have you.
Fulcher began spending all his spare time tracking down folk artists and recording their songs. One of his biggest finds was a man named D. Hicks, who had more than 100 centuries-old songs committed to memory. But getting to him wasn't easy.
When I walked up to the door, Oh, there were dogs chained up, and it was good that they were chained. You know, they were pulling on the chain, snarling.
Once safely past the dogs,
we started talking about music, and I recorded some banjo tunes right there.
One of Grandpa Jones's.
Each folk artist Fulcher met introduced him to still more artists he wanted to record. To get to them faster, Fulcher hired grad students using federal arts grants. Betsy Peterson was one of those early interns. She says Fulcher taught her that to connect with hill people, you have to move at their pace.
You have to learn to sort of step back and wait for the other individual to reveal themselves or reveal what they want to tell you.
Peterson is now the director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. She says that what's unique about the recordings Fulcher and his team assembled is the sheer volume of a collection built over a lifetime. Peterson says it's clearly a work of love.
He did fall in love with the people. Just hearing what they have to say and sort of drawing out the best in people, he's very good at that.
Hey, Clive. Yeah.
One of the artists Fulcher got closest to is fiddler Clive Davenport, named a national treasure by the National Endowment for the Arts.
Playing my old favorite, Betty Baker.
Davenport's in his 90s now. His fiddling has slowed, and he sometimes forgets how a song starts. But once on the bow, his fingers come alive. Seeing the end of his Park Service career on the horizon, Bobby Fulcher is now focused on sharing the music that's become his passion. He helped launch Sandrock Recordings to ensure Tennessee's traditional music reaches a wider audience.
You found something, you heard it, and then other people heard it, and they fell in love with it, you know, and you're a part of that. That's a wonderful feeling.
The label has released 9 albums of traditional music so far. 6 more are in the works. Fulcher now manages one of Tennessee's newest state parks and continues to add to the Folklife collection. For NPR News, I'm Mike Osborne in Murfreesboro, Tennessee.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from With Good Reason in Albemarle County, Virginia, the Allegheny Front in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, WMOT in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Petaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at @InAppalachia or @WVJessicaYLily. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.